Hello and welcome to another weekly edition of Popcorn Optional, your weekly movie podcast where we break down movie trailers, movies, movie news, movie anything that you really can think of. I'm Cameron Salina, and tonight I'm joined by my co-host Jake Brown and Trevor Allison. Hey guys.
What's up?
Hello.
Tonight we will be talking the brand new box office and critical hit as well, film It. The remake of, I guess it's not, well, I don't know. You guys can tell me if you think it's a remake or not, but the new version of the famous Stephen King novel about a creepy clown thingy. So, yeah. But before we get to that, we have a couple of news items. We're going to do another segment of underrated movies. Then we're going to talk about some trailers. Jake has something he needs to rant about. We'll get to our review of It, and then we will end with our content of the week. So let's go ahead and get into movie news. Today it was announced that Patty Jenkins is officially on for Wonder Woman 2. Guys, was this ever in doubt? Was this ever like, man, what if Patty Jenkins doesn't do this? Like, was there ever even a thought?
I mean, it makes the most sense. If they announced somebody else, I think everybody, including Patty Jenkins, would have been like, what the hell, guys? Yeah, I mean, obvious decision. And good for her. Like, well, very well deserved.
I mean, the time that it took to announce this was clearly the studio trying to get down the number that the agents were giving them. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why it took this long. I mean, as well as this one did, and it's still, like, gaining steam, I think people are still talking about it. I mean, I had some friends that like went to see it last weekend. So I think number two, wow. I think the hype is going to continue. And if Joss Whedon turns this Justice League thing into something watchable, then I think that's only going to help. So yeah, it's great. Patty Jenkins was awesome. She is awesome. Let's keep it rolling.
Well, the interesting thing about Justice League is that it came out this week that Zack Snyder will not be doing press tours for Justice League, which kind of goes towards the side of this, at least on the studios and for all publicity reasons, this is Joss Whedon's movie. And supposedly they're still filming reshoots. They're 2 months out, I think. It comes out, I think, mid-November.
Gosh.
Joss Whedon still is not going to sleep until then. There's no way.
He's not. And apparently he feels great about working with the studio because he still has Batgirl to come after this. And there's a couple rumors going around that he's going to be doing the next Justice League whenever they do part two. So all your superhero team-up films will now be directed by Joss Whedon, just so everybody knows.
Not a bad thing.
Moving on. Not a bad thing. There could be far worse people. Lars von Trier, Michael
Snyder.
Bay, Zack Snyder. Oh, too soon. Alrighty. There is a piece of news that came out this week. Actually, I'm interested in seeing a Tarek Malik Marvel film. Is that like? I think at a certain point when Marvel gets to the point where like, look, we've done everything. What else can we do? They should just let like famous directors have like a cut. Like, let's do a Fincher film. Let's do a Malick film. Like, let's just go weird with it.
I think it would be Malick just videoing frame by frame a comic book that he wrote and drew.
But then at the end, it's revealed that this is like actually Peter Parker, who's just been dreaming all of this all along.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's nominated for Best Picture.
there's a new story that came out today about how Rotten Tomatoes is affecting movies and box office. So Trevor, what do we take away from this story? Like give us a little information and tell us kind of what's going on.
All right, so the New York Times ran this story. I think it came out like last Thursday or Friday or something. It was being passed around the interwebs again today about how there's some studio executives and directors, most famously, I guess, in this piece, Brett Ratner, who was quoted directly.
Brett Ratner is the one leading the charge.
Right, I know. So, I mean, when you hear my response to this article, it's going to make a lot of sense and be directed right at Brett Ratner. But they're saying that Rotten Tomatoes is causing people to not go to the movies. The big example they cited was King Arthur, which they spent $170 million on or whatever, and it only made $40 million at the box office. And it had like a, I don't even remember what was it, like a 30 something on Rotten Tomatoes. And so they were blaming this. There's an interesting piece that came out in The Atlantic today as a rebuttal to that, that basically said, somewhat what I know how you two guys mostly feel about this also, which is like, make better movies. You, yeah, specifically, Brett Ratner, and everyone else in general, like, make better movies. If you're worried about what people think about your movies, then make good ones. I don't, this isn't like really hard. And I know that the Atlantic piece jumps into this really well, about how with fewer and fewer people going to the movies, studios are spending more money on fewer movies and kind of swinging for the fences, so to speak. And I understand that. And, so I get that business model, but I think that you can only do that kind of model only works with these proven franchises, proven characters, proven universes. Giving Guy Ritchie, who is maybe the master of the British gangster film, a medieval sort of fantasy sort of British gangster film, and giving him $150 or $180 million to do it, and it'd be very CGI heavy and all this other stuff, like, that's not a great bet. Like, I don't understand here. It's just silly. Like, make good movies. If you want people to go see the movies, make good movies.
Yeah. Brett Ratner was a producer on The Revenant. Did you guys know this?
I did not.
Oh, I did it.
Fascinating.
I guess I have to slightly take back what I said about him making better movies.
Well, in all fairness, the last movie he directed was Hercules, featuring The Rock, from 2014. So, yeah.
Hey, that's still bad. That's movies. A good rainy day film right there.
Said no one ever. Jake, what's your take on the whole Rotten Tomatoes thing?
X-Men 3, which is a garbage mess of a comic book movie.
That movie is absolutely terrible. And my take on the whole situation is, I think there's two things I want to point out. There's a scene in 30 Rock when they're making like a horror film based in Connecticut, and Jack, Alec Baldwin's character, gets involved and he's like, we're not going to make things that don't make money anymore. And basically by the end of the film, it's this like weird Connecticut propaganda piece for like the Visitor office, as well as like a puppet show and like a sponsored commercial for candy. And it's like, it's just a piece of garbage. But in his mind, he's like, it's already profitable because of the tax incentives and all of these other sponsorships. And like, that's what Hollywood has become now. In the new Transformers movie, Mark Wahlberg, playing Cade Yeager in the middle of nowhere of like a desert, drinking a random Asian milk-based beverage. And that's because they're targeting their audiences in China. When that happened in the theaters in China, Chinese people laughed. They were like, this is so stupid. Like, he wouldn't be drinking that. I think it's, so basically it's studios being more businesses than storytellers, which like, it's a business. Like, I totally understand and get it. But at the same time, if your product is story, you kind of have to put a premium on story. This is also just basically another situation where the old guard is blaming the new guard, quote, millennials. This is just another thing millennials are killing. We can play a setup with Applebee's and the housing market. Oh, yeah. Totally our fault, guys. The housing market collapsed. Whoops.
Stinking and basically, avocados.
Yeah, this is basically them blaming somebody else for being innovative and affecting their business. It's the same situation that happened with Tesla when all of the car dealerships sued Tesla, saying like, oh, that's not fair that they get to sell directly to consumers, or like the cab unions suing Uber.
Is this America like, or what?
I know. That's basically what this is the movie studios being like, well, Rotten Tomatoes doesn't make it fair anymore. It's like, well, just make a better movie. Like, it's not that freaking hard, guys. So yeah, I think this argument's ridiculous.
In further defense of millennials, to paraphrase something I saw on Twitter the other day, we aren't the ones who put carpet over all the hardwood floors.
Yeah, I do that. One of the things that is most frustrating about this is whenever you hear a studio or an actor or anybody say, like, critics, we didn't make this movie for the critics, we made it for the fans. And it's like, do you not think that movie critics are fans too? Like, our job as critics, and not like we have a small podcast, we're not, you know, A.O. Scott writing for the New York Times, but the job of any movie critic is to inform audiences on whether or not whatever we're reviewing is worth their time. And so, yeah, if somebody's going to give put a poor movie out in theaters, we're going to say, hey, don't go see this movie. And critics are going to go onto Rotten Tomatoes and say, this isn't worth your time. No, don't go see this. It's rotten. Like, that's what you bargain when you put out a movie like Transformers. That's just utter garbage. Like,
well, here's the other thing
you put into it.
They're blaming Rotten Tomatoes doesn't do anything except for aggregate movie reviews. Like,
right.
They're looking at Rotten Tomatoes as if Rotten Tomatoes is writing libel against their films, and they're like, oh, this is absurd. Like, this is a great piece of cinema, and like Rotten Tomatoes is making fun of us for... No, that's not what's happening. Rotten Tomatoes is literally just pulling all of the articles that are out there on the internet and just presenting it as an average, a number. That's what's happening. It's not Rotten Tomatoes going after you. It's you putting out garbage and someone calling you out.
It's like blaming the Dow Jones for the stock market going down.
Yeah.
Yeah. The funniest part of this all is that for years, studios have been putting Certified Fresh on not only movie posters, but on DVDs as a way to sell them.
Yeah.
They've been giving credit to Rotten Tomatoes as a, hey, look, Rotten Tomatoes says this is good, you should buy it. And now that they're giving bad reviews to their movies, they're going, hey, Rotten Tomatoes is stupid because why would you ever listen to them? Don't listen to them when we tried to use them to sell our movies for the longest time. So it's just hypocritical. I mean, the problem with this
fan making a movie for the fans or making a movie for a critics thing is that it supposes that you can only enjoy a movie in one of two ways. And we know that you can enjoy a movie in an infinite number of ways. Movie can hit different people different ways. We can like different things about different movies. I can love Top Gun, even though I know that from a technical standpoint, it's like a ridiculous film in so many ways. But just making that dichotomy for yourself just like sets you up for failure. It doesn't leave any interpretation to the viewer.
Yeah. And if you look at what we had this summer, the films that were big budgets and flopped and had bad Rotten Tomatoes scores were either reboots, sequels, or just absolutely horrible. Like, based on the trailer, you're like, no, I'm not gonna see that. Everything that was an original property or a really well done remake or first interpretation, like, Rotten Tomatoes scores only help your film. It's word of mouth, which is the most effective marketing in the world. And so if you just make good films, you'll have good word of mouth, and that's really all it takes, guys.
Yeah. I mean, look at this weekend as an example. Before any Rotten Tomatoes reviews had come out for it, it was already tracking as one of the highest grossing weekends of all time, and then it even exceeded that. So, yeah, Jake's completely right. It's word of mouth, and we saw that with Get Out. Get Out was a movie that, as word of mouth spread, it got more and more money coming in. And look at Wonder Woman. As people the first weekend said, hey, this is a film worth seeing, Wonder Woman had the lowest drop-off from weekend one to weekend two of any superhero movie all time. Normally, superhero movies drop off about 60 to 70% from weekend one to weekend two. Wonder Woman dropped off 30%. That's it. I mean, word of mouth.
It's also, make this a good is movie. Basically like, this is MoviePass again happening in the news cycle. Like, the theater chains are freaking out about MoviePass. Like, why? More people are going to go to the theater because it's more affordable for them. You're going to get your full price ticket from MoviePass, and they're going to spend that money they saved at concessions, which is marked up 600%. Like, and embrace change. Like, if, let's say AMC was like, MoviePass is amazing. For all MoviePass members, you get a free small popcorn or something. Like, do you know how many people would buy MoviePass and then go to AMC theaters? It's, I just don't understand the resistance to like change and opportunity that happens with, I don't want to say like the baby boomers, but all I'm saying is we didn't crash the stock market in 2008. I mean, that's all I'm going to say.
Heyo.
I mean, we were all 18 that year, so we can be blamed. Technically, we are adults at that time.
Yeah. I was looking for a job for a long time. Thanks a lot, guys.
Alrighty, well, moving on, we're going to do another segment of underrated movies where we talk about movies that we feel are underrated and that you should check out because you may have forgotten them, they may have been lost to time, they may have just not gotten the respect that they deserved when the movie came out. So, yeah, Trevor, what is your underrated movie?
Okay, this is actually going to be two movies that go together, and you guys are definitely going to laugh, and... But these movies are totally, totally fun and worth watching. And they are a little quick, small series from the early 90s called Sister Act. And if you don't know, they star Whoopi Goldberg as a nightclub singer who has to pretend like she's a nun in a convent as part of witness protection. And in the first one, she brings a little bit of her nightclub singing pizzazz to the nun's choir at this small Catholic church in San Francisco. The second one, she comes back and is a choir director for a Catholic school in San Francisco full of inner city kids. And there is some awesome music in these films, some great gospel versions of classic standard hymns and songs, and they're funny. It's Whoopi Goldberg being a nun, which is funny. They're a lot of fun. They're not like great or amazing or spectacular, but they're a lot of fun. They can keep you happy, keep you pleased. And there's a very young Lauryn Hill in Sister Act 2, which is kind of interesting, and a very young Jennifer Love Hewitt also.
Did not know that. Yes, I love these movies. These movies are a lot of fun. Great music. I do have a beef with these movies though. I grew up in an Assemblies of God, Christian church, and, I ended up dating a Catholic girl and, her family. And, you know, now we're married, but I will say the first time I went to Mass, I was very disappointed.
no rapping interludes.
Yeah, I was expecting a lot more nuns, a lot more like soulful singing sisters. but I agree with you, Trevor. These films are underrated.
There we go. I've got to be honest, I've never seen least not in times when I can remember. I've probably caught like 5 or 10 minutes on like TNT or TBS, one of those FX, because they have the movies. But I've never seen either of the Sister Act movies all the way through, so I can't really weigh in on whether or not these are good, bad, underrated, whatever they are. But I trust your guys' opinions, and yeah.
Like once a month, I will randomly think of one of the songs from that first Sister Act movie. The like, yeah. I Will Follow Him song just like gets stuck in my head once a month at least.
Yeah. My favorite is of course the big end number, the joyful joyful version they do on Sister Act 2. It's so good.
Very good. Okay. Well, Sister Act and Whoopi Goldberg. We can put that on her list of EGOTing. She is now underrated.
There you go.
I'll go ahead into my film because it's actually a segue off of the Sister Act theme. This is also a movie that focuses on the power of music and just how fun it can be. especially when you incorporate music and good music in the heart of a film and the heart of a script. This is by one of my favorite directors and features one of my favorite performances by who I think is an underrated actor, and that is School of Rock by Richard Linklater and featuring Jack Black.
Wow. You know, I think School of Rock is pretty like well regarded within the, you know, culture of cinema. But I would agree that it's underrated and that it's not loved enough, because it is flat out amazing. Like, that film is so good. What Jack Black, I mean, that's the role that Jack Black was born for. I think we can all agree on that. Like, he was born to play Mr.
You're right.
Schneble.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fake Mr. Schneble.
Sorry. Mr. S. Yeah, I think it's an incredibly underrated film. I'm all for School of Rock and really anything that Linklater does. He's a mensch. He's a mensch for sure.
Oh yeah.
I think Linklater's great. I think that Jack Black, I completely agree, is an underrated actor. He's fantastic. I mean, you know, he does his crazy goofy thing, but when he's being serious, he can be very good. I love him in The Holiday. He's great in that. I love him in King Kong, even though that movie's a mess.
Bernie.
That's probably
incredible.
Wait, which King Kong? Peter Jackson's King Kong?
Yeah.
That's a mess?
Oh yeah. It's way too long.
No. Really?
We can get into this later, but it's not good.
We're gonna have a whole podcast dedicated to movies that me and Trevor disagree on, and starting with Avatar, going into King Kong.
There we go. But yeah, I think at least in the circles that I ran in, I felt like School of Rock got quickly overrated. When I was in high school, people talked about it all the time and constantly, and I got a little fatigued on it. But now I've come all the way back around, and I think that it's so forgotten that it's underrated, that people kind of moved past it. But it is great. It's a lot of fun. I literally, like, if I hear someone say cello, I think cello. Like I can't. That's always in my head. Constantly.
Yeah. I think that my argument is basically that is like when it came out, it was like really well received, and then it kind of like Napoleon Dynamited, where it like got too popular and everyone like forgot about it, but then when we forgot about it, we also forgot that, like, oh, wait, this is actually an incredible movie, unlike Napoleon Dynamite. So, yeah, that's my.
It launched the career of John Heder.
Whoa, wow. What a career.
I think it was his career.
No, it definitely was. But yeah, it's Jake. What a good pick. That movie is it's fantastic. Way to go. Also, Mike White, writer of School of Rock, has a new movie coming out next week called Brad Status, featuring Ben Stiller. It's his directorial debut. So go Mike White.
Interesting.
The real Ned Schneble.
Schneble.
My pick for underrated movie of this episode is... Well, I'm going to go with the whole... I had two picks, but you guys both went music, so I'm going to keep on that theme. Mine is a film that I honestly think is one of the greatest comic book movies ever made. I think it is the most comic book movie ever made. I think it's expertly directed. I think it's perfectly cast and acted, and the story is hysterical, but also such a commentary on music and relationships. And that movie is Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Absolutely.
Okay. Guys, I still haven't seen this. I know.
Trevor, you're going to love it.
I know that I'm going to love it. I understand that. I know all about it. I don't know all about it. I know the basic premise. I know the style. I know that I love Michael Cera, who always plays high schoolers, and I'm cool with that.
He does.
I mean, it grossed $47 million off of an $85 to $90 million budget. It, I think, has like a 60 on Rotten Tomatoes. Yet it's like there are very few flaws in this movie, and it has an insane cast: Michael Cera, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Kieran Culkin, Ellen Wong, Allison Pill, Anna Kendrick, Brie Larson, Aubrey Plaza, Chris Evans, Brandon Routh, Mae Whitman, Jason Schwartz. I mean, the cast is just a who's who of star actors. So, not to mention it's pretty darn creative. So, Jake, you've seen this, right?
Yeah, and this is one of those films that like went under the radar for me for a really long time, and then I just like I need to sit down and watch this, and this movie blew me away. I think it really speaks to how underrated it is that I always forget about it, but then when someone brings it up, I'm always like, man, I love that movie. So yeah, it's fantastic, and really just kind of sets up the director that Edgar Wright has become today with Baby Driver and the Coronado trilogy.
Yep. Well, that's underrated movies for the week. Let's get on to trailers. There's two trailers that we kind of want to talk about. The first of which being Mudbound, the new Dee Reese film that comes out this year. And Trevor, you had a chance to watch this. What did you think of the trailer?
Oh man, this looks really good. It's another one in this line of movies that deal with racial issues in the history of America and in a much more realistic way than what most people get in their history class. And I think this is going to be in a similar vein to 12 Years a Slave or Detroit or Selma, a very important film. It looks like it's going to be very well acted. It's got a great cast. It looks very intense. I think that it's going to be very heavy, but I think it's going to be very good.
Yeah. I've been on the Garrett Hedlund is a secretly great actor who has lots of bad roles trained for a while, and I feel like Garrett Hedlund's finally going to get his come up in this movie. But there's other people like... There's Mary J. Blige in this trailer, and you wouldn't, like, if I was to give you 100 guesses as to which actress that was, you would never guess that that was her. She just completely transforms. Jason Mitchell, who played Eazy-E in Straight Outta Compton, is also in this. You got Jonathan Banks from Breaking Bad, Carey Mulligan, Jason Clarke. I mean, the cast is great, and Dee Reese has put out some great films the past couple of years, so... Look for that film to come out on Netflix November 17th. Alrighty, well, those are trailers for the week. Jake, I understand that you need to rant about something.
Yeah, guys, this is a long time coming, and I felt this way for a while, but this weekend it really just kind of really, really hit me on how passionately I dislike the movie tavern idea. Where it's dinner and a movie combined. And you know, this would be the movie tavern business pitch right here. What if we combined dinner and a movie into one horrible experience? Success! In reality, the idea of a movie tavern is solid, but it's ruined by surprise people. People ruin everything. I had a couple come in next to me 10 minutes into it. They were 10 minutes late after the trailers, which ran for like 20 minutes. And then they used their phone flashlight to read the menu. And then a guy asked if they would turn off the light. And then the lady yelled at him to F off. So great way to start the film. then the waiter came in to take their order and is practically yelling back their order in like a very quiet part of the film. This guy was so loud. How is a movie theater waiter louder than a beer salesman at a baseball game? If you aren't there by the end of the trailers, you shouldn't be allowed to order in the theater. Like, that should be the rule. And the amount of people going back and forth and back and forth in front of the screen, it is so distracting. And, you know, fortunately, they make up for this annoyance, this experience of incredible distraction with incredible food. Oh, wait, no. It tastes like reheated food from Chili's, which was already reheated when you ordered it at Chili's. It just sucks. The only chain that does like this at an acceptable level is Alamo Drafthouse, but even they are riding a fine line as they grow. And so I'll just now in general be avoiding the quote movie tavern concept. It's almost a deal breaker for me, and I'm just sick of it. So that's my rant about movie taverns.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. Yeah,
I completely agree. They're uncomfortable. They're like, I don't know. If you want to eat, go eat. If you want to watch a movie, watch a movie. I don't understand why this is so difficult. Yeah, the food's not good. The people are annoying. Why would you want to be drinking more water that makes you need to go to the bathroom during the movie? You can't pause. Like, if you want to eat during a movie, do it at home. I don't get this.
I will say, Jake, you hit on this, but I am like, my favorite movie theater is Alamo Drafthouse. If there is an Alamo Drafthouse closer to me, I think the closest one's like 30 minutes away. If there was one closer, I would only go see movies at Alamo. They do it right, in my opinion. They kind of have the waiters hiding, and the way that you order is writing on a card to where you're not actually talking. And if you do talk or are on your cell phone, you get kicked out of the movie theater. Mm-hmm. And their food's actually pretty good. Like, they have the best strawberry milkshake I've ever had in my entire life.
But, yeah, I'm a fan of Alamo Drafthouse, and like their love for films is infectious. You know, it's just such a fun place to go see a movie.
You know that you're seeing the movie with the best crowd possible to see that. Like, they're gonna laugh when you should laugh. They're gonna they're not gonna laugh when you shouldn't laugh. Like, those are the people that you want to see movies with.
Yeah, I saw it at Movie Tavern in like the West 7th area of downtown Fort Worth. Ugh, it was a mistake.
They have lost your business forever.
Yeah.
If I'm guessing.
Yeah. They have lost the money of Movie Pass forever.
The funny thing is that what Movie Taverns had going for them for the longest time was that they had these like massive lazy boy reclining chairs. But movie theaters are starting to get smart, and the Cinemark that I go to mostly now has those reclining chairs without any sort of waiter service dining-esque place, to where it's best of both worlds. I can recline in my seat, lay down, watch a movie, and not have to worry about waiters walking up and down the place.
Yep.
So there are options if you like the comfy seats. But yeah. Good rant, Jake. Let's go on and get to our review of the hit film It, which is going to be confusing to talk about for the rest of the night, because we're going to say, well, when I saw it, and we're going to go, this whole entire week as we've been texting about the movie, I've had to like capitalize It and make sure that it's like, okay, does that stand out in a way that it's like, I'm talking about the movie It and not like It as in like a different It, whatever. It's a fantastic name, though, but it is a group of bullied kids band together when a shape-shifting demon taking the appearance of a clown begins hunting children. This film was projected at the highest projections to make $75 million this weekend domestically. It made $125 million. It made $50 more than what they thought it would make on a $35 million budget. That's just domestically. It made another $70 million overseas. I mean, it has done five times its production budget of $35 million. It's the highest opening weekend for a horror film ever. It's the highest opening weekend of a September movie ever. And it made $13.5 million on Thursday night. And to put that in comparison, Guardians of the Galaxy made $17 million, which is the highest that any film has made on a Thursday night this year so far. It's a commercial success by all means. So now that we've got the financial side of it out of the way, guys, what do we think of the film, Jake?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of good horror movies, and I hate bad horror movies, and this is a good horror movie, and it is a surprisingly funny horror movie. It hits all the right emotional notes, fantastic performances by the entire cast, and like from kids. These kid actors bring it. And Skarsgård, who plays Pennywise, my goodness, he you brought it as well. I have a few little complaints, but overall a great horror film that turned out to be a lot more fun than scary.
Yes. Trevor.
Yeah, I don't like horror films. I've seen very few. I don't want to be scared. All that being said, I think this is a very good movie. I enjoyed this movie. It's very accessible for a horror film. I'd really say it's an adventure film with horror elements. The horror part of it really pulls you into the story and adds to the story. This film doesn't exist just to scare you, like so many horror films. This film exists to tell you a story, and it tells you a story that's terrifying, so it does it in a terrifying way. I really enjoyed a lot of things about this film. It was funny, although no, I was the only person in my theater that laughed like the entire movie. I don't know if everyone else was way more scared than I was and couldn't let it go or what, but I thought it was funny. I thought the acting was fantastic by everyone. We'll get into specifics about that, but overall, I think this was a really good movie that I liked a lot more than I expected to.
I've been on record before saying that I do not like horror films. And what I said to my wife this weekend after we saw the movie was, this is the first horror film ever that I want to see again. Like, I am actually interested in seeing this movie for a second time. And that's not something I ever say about horror films. So, I mean, this movie is just awesome. You guys have hit on the cast. Fantastic. It's hard to get. I think in movies like this where the kids are so lovable, relatable, they're dynamic on screen. I think in a movie like that, it seems like it's so effortless. But then you watch films that have terrible kids and it makes movies like this look even better. I mean, it's hard to get great performances out of kids or to find kids that perfectly fit roles or that have chemistry with the other kids. And the stars of this movie are the kids. I mean, this is Stranger Things level of great kid performances. You fall in love with these kids and you go on this journey and you feel like you're part of the losers. Like you're part of the losers club by the end of this movie and you are going with them through every single up and down. I mean, I loved this movie. I thought it was great. Big, big fan.
Did you guys have clowns in your theater?
No.
I had no clowns in my theater. Did you have clowns in your theater?
Not in my theater seeing the film, but I was at Alamo Drafthouse in downtown Dallas Saturday night for a like after party of a filmmakers conference I was at. And so we were on like the patio and this car pulls into the parking lot, tiny little blue car and six clowns.
Of course.
Yeah. I was like, holy crap, guys, an actual clown car just pulled up. Six. So we're all like watching and people are filming with their phone and like, this is hilarious. And a clown looks up at us and drags his thumb across his throat, like the slitting the throat symbol.
Oh, gosh.
And we were all like, So, yeah, the clowns were out in force, and it was kind of terrifying.
I should say clowns are very upset about this movie. There are many clowns that tried to get boycotts of this movie, tried to get this movie to not play in theaters because they are worried that this is going to affect their business, which to that I say, how much business do clowns still have?
I say to that, like, good. Secondly, it's been out for a long time. Like, this isn't a new thing.
The book is 30 years old.
It's that old?
Yeah.
The book came out in like 86, I think.
Yeah, 86. Wow, this is 30 years old. And when did the original TV mini 1990s when the original TV miniseries came out? But I mean, arguably, this is a very much more great job there talking, Cam. This is a much more realistic, terrifying version on screen than anything we've seen so far. I mean, it's one thing to have something in a book. I don't know why I'm defending clowns and their outrage over this movie right now. Yeah, I think it's ridiculous.
I feel like we kind of have to go into spoilers to be able to talk about this.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out, like, how do we talk about this movie without getting into spoilers? But, like, the very first scene of this movie is a huge spoiler.
Yeah.
and it kind of kicks off everything. So if you haven't seen It and you're one of the few people that didn't go see it this weekend, please go see it. It's fantastic. You'll enjoy it. Even if you don't like horror films, take it from somebody who doesn't like horror. Go see it. It's worth it. Please, please, please. You're going to love it. But let's go ahead and get into spoilers. That opening scene. Okay, so what's your guys' background with It, first of all? Like, have you guys read the book? Did you see the original 1990s miniseries?
Nope. Had no concept other than the fact that it was a clown that could, like, shapeshift into your fear.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I knew that, like, the... in this town, like, an unusual number of kids went missing.
Mm-hmm.
And then besides that, I knew whatever was in the trailer. That's pretty much it. I wasn't really familiar with it at all. And I knew that Tim Curry was in the original.
Oh, Tim Curry. What a fantastic man.
Yeah.
What was your guys' reaction to that opening scene?
Dude.
I don't know why I'm laughing right now. Very disturbing.
I was not ready for it. And the girl sitting next to me was not ready for it either.
I was like, well, this is it. We're doing this thing. Like, this is not the It Comes at Night kind of horror.
No.
No.
We know exactly what's going on and why we should be scared of it.
A kid's arm.
Yeah,
just
they
got
set the stage
by a clown.
Oh my gosh. And they, like, I think TV has cultivated us to where, like, we expect for them to, like, cut to, like, down the street and we get a blurry background shot of, like, water turning red, and like that's our context for like Georgie got eaten by the clown. But well, I mean, this movie goes for it.
Yeah,
and we got teased there. We got teased where the shots of Georgie looking into the sewer are like perfectly framed for that old woman on her porch to come up behind him and be like, "Hey, stay away from the sewers." It cuts to that woman a couple times, and there's the addition of those slightly little things gives you this hope that just then gets literally eaten.
Literally eaten. And it's graphic, like the way that they show his arm, like a little kid, a what, 6, 7, 8-year-old kid's arm brutally. Oh, I, at that point in the movie, was kind of like, I don't know if I can do this. I got out.
See,
and I think
it, like, it, like,
my
bizarrely,
wife had the same reaction.
See, it like bizarrely calmed me, because it's like, now I know what to expect from
what?
This. Like
at
going
that
into
point,
the film,
I didn't know what to expect. I was like, they can do anything, and like they're going for it. They're not gonna pull any punches.
I can see that. I can see that.
But I will say that scene sets the stage for the entire movie, and I don't know if we get. I think there's maybe like one scene that maybe as horrifying as that scene, and it has nothing to do with the clown whatsoever. But everything else is like, oh, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase it. Like, okay, I think that scene sets up the terror in a way that from there you're not as worried about being scared, or you're not as scared because you've already seen something truly horrifying that you're like, well, how much higher can they go? So I get, Trevor, I get what you're saying there, but it's like the rest of the movie seemed tamer and more enjoyable, or like easier to digest because of that. Does that make sense?
It does a good job at like setting the stakes immediately. And so you know at like what it makes Pennywise more terrifying from the start. You immediately are like, holy crap, this is something very serious, not to be trifled with. And then throughout the rest of the film, anytime he is around, you immediately think back to that first scene and you know what could happen. And so like anytime Pennywise is scaring one of the kids or like feeding off of their fear, you're in the back of your mind the entire scene, you're like, oh my god, is he gonna eat them too? Oh my gosh. And then he does something super scary, but he doesn't eat them, and so you're like, oh, okay, ooh, it's okay. And then, like, later on, they do a good job at setting high expectations at the beginning and then eclipsing those expectations at the end. If they didn't have such a, like, intense time in the sewers and stuff, it wouldn't have been a good setup and payoff. It would have been a disappointment that the first scene was so intense. But I think they did a good job at, like, using that to set themselves up for the rest of the film.
Right.
I agree.
Let's talk a little bit about the story as a whole, because I think that there are some pieces that are really well done, and I think there are some pieces where they miss. How did you guys, like, so the movie's framed around the Losers Club and how they bring, how it is this group of close-knit friends who all start encountering this demonic being who's a shape-shifting nightmare that takes the presence of a clown most times, but everybody views him in different ways. How did you guys feel about the interactions between the Losers Club? Because I don't want to have you guys be like, oh, well, I guess that. But I'm curious if there's anything within the Losers Club that didn't work for you guys.
I think there might have been like one or two too many kids. I feel like there were like four or five of them that were really core to the story and really brought it. I don't think we really needed Stan or Mike.
Yes.
They didn't add that much. But them being there didn't hinder the story, I don't think. I loved the Losers Club. I wanted to be a loser.
Yeah. Yeah. The interesting thing about Mike is that I read a little bit today. He's actually like the narrator of the book.
Yes.
So that's kind of an interesting, I mean, obviously the film didn't take that. I felt like his character, there could have been a little bit more. I mean, I obviously there was like fear bonding in the truest sense here between these kids. But I think that the way that Mike joined the group was like a little bit too easy and a little bit kind of unnatural. It could have been a little bit smoother handled, I think. But I think I was really fine with them. I think the kids had good dynamics. I think they all played their roles well within the group and the acting as well. I think that Finn Wolfhard did a great job of not being Mike from Stranger Things, even though this movie is similar to Stranger Things in a lot of ways. But he's completely different. It would have been very easy to kind of fall into what he did for Stranger Things, but he's a lot different. I think that Jaden Lieberer as Bill was probably the best out of all of them. He embodies kind of what this movie...
Jaden Lieber of Book of Henry fame?
Yeah, which we did not see, famously. he really embodies kind of the themes of this book, and he is, like, I mean, he's the hero of the story, and I think that he does a great job of showing what needs to happen, doing what needs to be done, having the courage, having the bravery, having the strength. I think he truly is a worthy hero for this story.
Yeah. So Jake, you hit on one point that I was trying to get at, which was that Mike and Stan felt out of place. Stan could have very easily been absorbed into Eddie's character. I think they have a lot of very similar beats. And Mike is originally, he's what like Ben does in the film as like the historian librarian person, to my understanding, is actually Mike. Mike's the one that gives them the history lesson on it. And so that was kind of a weird, I think it fits more for Ben's character being the new kid. Not to mention he had the most horrifying introduction to Pennywise. That scene in the basement of the library is horrifying. And then there is also Mike's scene where you look over at the bushes and Pennywise has a child's arm that he's waving at Mike with, and that's pretty off-putting as well.
So is that Georgie's arm?
No,
I don't. Oh, I guess that would make sense. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, I guess so. I kind of connected it to the hands trying to reach out of the butcher shop from the fire that he had
seen before.
I thought that
too. I wasn't sure, but I just remembered that Georgie had his arm ripped off, so...
I mean, yeah, it definitely could be.
No, I think that makes sense. the story point that frustrates me in this movie is that you have a close, tight-knit group of friends who are all young kids, and Bill, who constantly is the one bringing the group together. He's the one constantly being the ringleader. I mean, at times, Bev takes that role in a fantastic... First of all, Sophia Lillis is amazing in this movie. She deserves so much credit. She's fantastic.
Yeah.
But for the most part, Ben is the one that brings everybody together. And so, or not Ben, Bill. So for Bill to be the person who kind of, I guess that Richie is the one that pushes the group apart, but he's the one who punches Richie and then kind of forces everybody to break apart. I don't know how you, like, your guys' childhood went, but like, I would get into fights with my friends and you'd punch them one second and the next second you would be like, hey, are we good? Yeah, we're good. And you'd be back to being normal. And so the fact, like, I'm tired of this trope where like something has to go wrong in the group and then the group comes back together. Like, it just seems, it's such an overdone trope. And I love it so much more whenever the actors, or not the actors, the characters are the ones who can easily, like, they put their friendship above everything else. And they are the ones who are like, their friendship stands the test of time. Like, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. They don't break apart just for the sake of breaking apart. Like, I don't feel like what actually happened was enough to break them apart for months to where they wouldn't see each other all summer.
I kind of disagree just because of like all the stuff they went through, like together as a group, but also individually, and like what's on the line. And I think it, I definitely understand your like frustration with the amount, like the trope you said. I think that's a good way to say it, but it definitely is like storytelling 101. Kind of thing where it's like a major setback that then the protagonists have to come together and like they have to risk it all and they have to face the biggest obstacle and have the biggest battle and blah blah blah. So for me it didn't feel forced. I thought it felt more organic than them being like, hey buddy, everything's okay. But that's just me. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it mostly worked for me as well. I think what could have helped it would be that montage of getting the band back together. Could have taken a little bit longer and maybe a little bit more work and a little bit more convincing.
Yeah, there could have been a good talk between Richie and Bill or something.
Yeah. But at the same time though, I kind of see, I mean, emotions are running high. These kids almost died. No one is quite as committed to this as Bill is, based on his experience with Georgie, of course. So I can kind of see these other kids getting fed up with it. Like, we've almost died. This is too much. But then they kind of go their own ways, but it takes the disappearance of one of their own to make it real for all of them. And I think it is somewhat of a trope, and I think it's used poorly a lot of times, but it worked for me here.
Yeah, I think that the kids sell it well. I think I don't think I articulated this well, but I think my bigger frustration is just that they feel like they have to that felt like it had to be done in order to have a reason to bring the kids back together. Like, I just felt like it was something like they had to do. And like, well, I guess we should do this. It happens all the time. It wasn't needed. Like, it didn't add anything to the film. If anything, it gave us 5 minutes of like random montage for them to then be like, hey, Beverly's been taken. Let's all get back together. When the person whose reaction I was really interested in, when you find out that Bev's been taken, is Ben, and we don't really see his reaction at all. It's just kind of like, hey, he's on his bike, and then they're all riding to the house when it's like he's the one that's in love with her.
I will say, if you could like take stock in ideas, like actually purchase stock on concepts or themes for a year, would have been a good year to buy stock in kids riding bikes.
1980s kids and horror films.
So, okay, one thing that I want to talk about is I personally think we see too much of Pennywise like they do a really good job of kind of like teasing him throughout, and it's terrifying. But I definitely am a believer in the Jaws principle of the more you see a monster, the less scary it becomes. And so I think towards the end, we'd seen so much of him that he started to kind of lose his mystery and like the creepiness factor of just the fear of the unknown. But that also is like, what is Pennywise? Like, do we learn where he comes from, or like what happened? Like, what?
We don't learn it, I mean, in the film, and that's a negative. But Jake, I think you hit on one of my favorite aspects of the film is that as the film goes on, Pennywise becomes less scary. And I think that mirrors how the kids feel about Pennywise.
That's a good point.
I think it mirrors that the kids become less and less scared of him. And so he's not as scary. And the moment that you realize that they're not scared, all of a sudden it's like, I remember like watching the movie and being like, the second they're like, we're not scared. It's kind of like, hey, I, you know what? Yeah, he's not as scary as I thought. Mm. And
that's a good point.
It's such a impactful moment that I think that's like the greatest strength of the film.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
I can see that. But to your second part,
I think the difference there with between kind of what both of you guys are saying is this movie is not here to just scare you. That's not why it exists. It's here to tell a story, like I said, that's terrifying, so it's going to scare you. But yeah, I agree with what Cam was saying that as the fear of the characters starts to wane some, so does the fear of the audience. And I think that's a pretty clever way to kind of frame your story and to use the visual cues and the editing aspects of it to do that.
That's a good point.
Yeah, all but right. To your second point about us knowing what Pennywise is, I think because I had tried to like research without actually like giving things away for myself, I was like, I wonder, like, cause I had, heard about like Pennywise. And so I was like, I wonder, like, I want to research this a little bit. I had a little bit of outside knowledge. But Jake, you bring up a good point of how we don't really get any context as to what or who, Pennywise is. And I think that's intentional for the reason that there is going to be a chapter two, and we will hopefully get more then. But the backstory as to what Pennywise is bizarre, and it is so much weirder than anything we see on screen.
Well, it's Stephen King, so that's not surprising.
Yes.
Apparently, I didn't. Did you guys stay after the credits?
No.
Yes. Or no, I didn't, but I heard about what happens.
I did not, and so I read about it later. Apparently there's like there's some kind of signal that Pennywise is still alive.
Yeah, then you know, that song that like you hear kids singing, I think like on the TV, or it's called Oranges and Lemons. There are kids singing that song, and then as that song's being sung, you hear Pennywise's laugh indicating that he has survived.
Well, there was a second film planned, so not really surprised.
Yeah. Supposed to come out in 2019, and with the huge box office success, it'll happen, and it takes place 27 years later, where the Losers Club comes back to Derry, Maine, to defeat Pennywise once and for all. And the director has already said that he would like for Jessica Chastain to play an older version of Bev.
Mm. Yeah, I did you guys see that thing from the Hollywood Reporter where the kids said who would they casted who they want to play them?
Oh, no.
It's fantastic. Like the cast it's perfect. Like the kids nailed it. They should just sign all these people.
Do you have
to
that list
now.
Up right now?
Let me pull it up.
While you're doing that, I want to talk really quick about how fantastic like the editing and sound work and camera work were on this, and the music to just add to the overall creepiness, and like how original some things were, like the Pennywise dancing and the clown thing, and they like stabilized the frame on his face, and so his face never moved, but the whole frame was moving as you just had this like creepy slow zoom in, like stuff like that. This film just knocked it out of the park on this stuff.
Yeah, Jake, I think you hit on a big point there, which is we have not given very much success to Andres Muschietti, who is the director of this movie, and how well his vision for this world came together. He directed a film from 2013 called Mama, which goes even better to the fact that Jessica Chastain could be in it, because Jessica Chastain was in Mama, but that's the only other film that he has. Have you guys seen Mama?
Nope.
No, I have not.
I've heard good things about it, but I haven't been... It's a horror film, so I haven't checked it out. But yeah, his vision for this universe and the aesthetics of the time period just plays so well. And I think it's... Jake, I think you hit it out of the park. What we've not talked about much is how much of a technical master this film is.
I found that article. Finn Wolfhard, who is Richie, suggested Bill Hader.
Yes.
Mike Hanlon's, Chosen Jacobs, who's Mike, suggested Chadwick Boseman.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Jessica Chastain was Sophia Lillis's suggestion. Jeremy Ray Taylor, who plays Ben, suggested Chris Pratt.
What's funny is that character grows up to be, his weight plays a big issue, and so he grows up to be, jacked.
Oh, yeah. And then the last one, I don't know why they didn't have Eddie and Stan.
I loved Eddie.
Yeah, Eddie was great. The last one is Jaden Lieberer, who played Bill. It was Christian Bale.
I don't know about that one.
These are mostly good, and they sound very expensive also.
Yes, they do.
But the good news is that with this film making as much as it did, I think the studio is going to be pretty confident going, okay, let's give you an extra $25 million. Because even if this film costs $60 million, it's going to make that money back pretty quickly based off the success of this film. And that $25 million is going to go a very long way in terms of getting better actors to play the adult version of these kids.
I could see the budget eclipsing $100 million after the success of this weekend.
Yes. And let us begin to beg Andy Muschietti to not use a lot more CGI since he has a lot more money.
Okay, so that's a complaint of mine, actually, is the CGI in certain areas of this were pretty wonky.
Okay, yeah, with the kids. That's what, yeah.
Like, the painting was there, lady was horrible.
Yes. What did you guys, there's a scene, the rock throwing, rock fight, rock war.
Yeah, that was bad.
Scene. There's a couple shots in there where it's like, you can tell these kids were green screened in dramatically.
Yeah, it's very weird. It doesn't look right.
If you do get into the background of what Pennywise is, that's going to take a lot of CGI budget. Because if you explain what he is, what universe he lives in, who his actual enemy is, that's going to be some pretty big CGI stuff. Which I've gone back and forth as to whether or not they actually need to put that in there. I don't know how much it really serves the core story or how much it would add to us understanding who Pennywise is. Do you guys have anything else on this movie?
I have something to talk about. I kind of want to get your guys' thoughts on. So the kind of foundation of the story, what makes this whole thing work, I think is pretty clever from Stephen King. And it's the idea that only the kids are really able to see these things and understand what's going on. And I think that's an interesting way for him to take on this thing that you often, a criticism of lots of story in these kids' movies is where are the parents? Why are they allowed to just run around and do whatever they want? Or why is this going on? But here, I think King deals with that. Muschietti by extension, the idea that the parents are just oblivious to this whole thing that's going on. And I think it's also an interesting commentary on adults and how they see things differently than kids do. What do you guys think about that?
I think you nailed it.
I think the coolest part of that is the commentary on just because kids only see something, or just because something's not, real world, not that Pennywise isn't real, but he's more mythical, somewhat in their head. Just because things are in your head or not seen by adults doesn't make them any less scary to a kid. That aspect of growing up of you have things that happen as a kid that you always feel like your parents don't understand or probably is in your head, whether it's social things or whatnot. But that doesn't make any of those things less scary just because they're not seen by adults. If anything, it makes them more scary because nobody else understands what it is. And you as a kid have to handle that on your own. And that's part of growing up is learning to handle those social moments on your own. And not that, you know, when either any of us were growing up, we had to deal with a crazy clown trying to kill us. But, you know, we all had different fears and everything that come with being a teen growing up. And that's something I think that this film comments on beautifully.
As a follow-up to that, what do you guys think about, like, Eddie's mom being the only one, the only adult who can kind of sense that something weird is going on? Because she talks about that at the end where he says, like, I know these are placebos, they don't do anything, and she says, I'm trying to protect you. Do you think she's, like, just a crazy weird germaphobe, or do you think she, like, really understands something's going on but doesn't know what?
I didn't think of that when it first happened. I thought she was just being, like, an overprotective mom. That's kind of... I took it as a way of, like, showing a version of adult fear.
I think another interesting thing that goes along with this kind of part of the whole story is kind of what's fascinating to me, this whole kids versus adults thing. And we get these glimpses of this children's show that's always on TV. and it's kind of this thing where, like, the parents don't pay attention. And it goes into that same thing, the commentary I was saying about parents not paying attention. Like if it looks like a kid's show and it sounds like a kid's show, it's probably a kid's show, even though the woman on there is telling you to kill everyone. Like, I thought that was an interesting kind of look into and an interesting take on, or part of the filling the society there in Derry, and kind of like showing how the presence of this creature really affects the entire town, whether they know it or not.
Yeah. The world building here is really top notch. Every little moment they have, they're able to kind of pull you deeper in with just the period pieceness of it. But also, like you said, Trevor, just little things like TV shows and stuff like that. My only complaint about this film is I hated the amount of, like, splitting up the kids do, like, after giving a speech about how we have to stick together and blah, blah, blah. Bill, like, wanders down the sewer by himself. That kind of ticked me off, because that's, like, dumb horror movie tropes of, like, I'm just going to follow this thing. What's over here? It's like, no, stay together, idiots. Like, you just talked about it. But that's really the only, like, thing story-wise that really frustrated me with this movie. Otherwise, I mean, this is great. This is one of my favorite movies of the summer, at least. And we had a pretty good summer.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we did. Had a pretty good summer. Trevor, so you just brought up something that I've been, like, thinking about this entire time. So the clown comes every 27 years, is that right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
So I wonder if one of the reasons why the parents or adults in this town are so messed up is because of their interactions with Pennywise when they were kids. Like, are we seeing the 27 years later of what it was like in their childhood with Pennywise?
And no one was able to, like, figure it out like these kids have to really get to the bottom of what's going on.
Yeah, like, they either, like, saw something terrifying and were terrorized, or, like, they lost somebody close.
Right, and we see that Pennywise, while being very powerful, is not all powerful. You can't escape. So, theoretically, many of these adults may have been in those similar situations.
Well, I think it goes to the idea of fear just breeds more fear. I think it just really goes to that point, you know, of, like, if these parents did... if they did have crazy interactions with Pennywise but didn't, like, hunt him down the way that these kids have, no one's going to talk about that. Like, people don't talk about stuff that happened in their childhood that messed them up, especially in the 80s. Like, no, but mental health wasn't a thing, you know? And so, I definitely think that could explain for the weirdness that's going on in the town, for sure.
And I think the realest example we see of this is Henry, who with his fear of his dad, like, driving him to basically just follow Pennywise's orders because he's so blinded by fear, he can't control himself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cause I didn't really realize that. And I didn't realize it until, you know, the, the scene with him and his dad and the gun is like the catalyst for this. Like it's when his fear becomes just completely out of control. Then he kills his dad, which was insane.
Yeah, that scene, that's the only other scene that was for me as graphic as that opening scene with Georgie.
Yeah, that was a rough one.
All righty, well, let's get to our ratings of this movie. Jake, what would you give it?
I really enjoyed this movie. This is a fun way to end the summer, when generally it's pretty crappy movies around this time of year. And I'm a huge fan of good horror, and this is good horror. And I'm excited to see the next installment of this franchise, which I'm sure it will become. So I'm going to give it a-.
Solid. Trevor?
Yeah, I liked this movie too a lot more than I expected to. It's a great story. It's a great world. Great characters, very interesting. And the ending of a whole bunch of kids just beating the crap out of a demon clown is incredibly satisfying. That's just, I mean, you know, it's like the purest form of justice. And this, and it exterminates all of your fear coming
Richie,
out of this
Richie's
film. And I love that.
Speech was fantastic. That turn.
Oh my gosh. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, oh, that was great. He even sold me for a second.
Yeah.
I was like, you know what? He's done. I was like, I thought he was done. And then the more he was talking, I was like, all right. And then the way he casually picks up the baseball bat.
Yeah.
Reminiscent of another Stranger Things experience, of Jean Ralphio's father using a baseball bat so well. anyway, I'll get to so my rating. I'm gonna give this one 23 out of 27 years.
Oh, nice.
So I liked it. I thought it was pretty good. And like Cam said, maybe the first horror movie I've ever seen that I want to see again. And excited for the sequel.
I'm with you guys. This film for me is a B+. It is solid. That's probably the highest rating I've ever given a horror film. And it's due to the cast. They're all just fantastic and make this film so enjoyable. We didn't really talk about how great Bill Skarsgård was. The whole time
he was terrifying.
I remember going into the movie and I was like, yep. Terrifying. And the whole time I was sitting there, I'm like, there's no way he's going to be as good as Will Poulter would have been had he stuck with the role. But man, he killed it. And he completely made me even forget that Will Poulter was supposed to play this character.
If Poulter had been in this and Detroit within a month of each other, good Lord.
Yeah. I think he would forever have people running away from him on the streets had that happened. But supposedly, so all the scenes where, I just read this, all the scenes where Bill Skarsgård, his eyes roll or like go like cross-eyed or anything like that, he actually can physically do that in real life.
Ugh.
What?
Yeah, that's a practical thing that he does every time.
that's casting right there. That's what that is.
Can you imagine being a kid and seeing that like actually happen and just like...
God.
Oh man,
these poor children.
Yeah, apparently they would keep, like, they wouldn't let Skarsgård interact with the kids unless they were actually filming, to keep the kids terrified of him.
Smart.
Like, they wouldn't let him just like hang out on set.
It's good direction right there.
Yep.
Yeah, so that is our review of It. Expect the sequel probably sometime in 2019, especially with how great it did at the box office. And I'm going to guess that going into weekend two, it'll probably keep up that pace. But let's get to our content of the week. Jake, what is your content of the week?
I have been just like crazy, crazy busy, so I really haven't been consuming much content, but I did get a chance to hang out with some friends of mine this weekend at a filmmaking conference in Dallas, and they are some incredible filmmakers, so I'm just going to plug some of my friends really quick. Ryan Booth is an incredible cinematographer and director who's doing a lot of awesome work. Jared Hogan, a very, very creative guy who's doing things that really nobody else is doing right now, especially in the music video world. And then my friend Justin Robinson, who is an incredible writer director and is working on a very powerful documentary about his own life on the loss of his brother. That's very similar to a like the Dear Zachary feel. And yeah, those guys are up and comers, man. So check out their work on Vimeo or Instagram or whatever. They're super talented. Trevor, what about you?
All right, I've got a few things. Number one, we've talked about it a little bit, but if somehow you have not seen Stranger Things, like, stop what you're doing. Go on Netflix.
Days.
Don't even sleep. Just watch the whole thing. If you liked It, you'll love Stranger Things, I promise. There's definitely some inspiration of It and Stranger Things, as well as Stand By Me, which is based on another Stephen King story. But Stranger Things, it's on Netflix. It's one of the best TV shows I've ever seen. I mean, just go see it. Another thing is that I want to recommend that Jake called recommending, but he hasn't done it yet, so I'm going to steal it.
Sorry, I forgot.
And it is the newest album by the pretentious hipster band LCD Sound System, which is really just one guy mostly. The album is called American Dream, and it's amazing music. Electronic dance punk? I don't know what genre it is. It's really good. I specifically recommend the songs Call the Police and Tonight, but LCD Sound System American Dream, it's great. Their first album in 7 years. Very good. And my last thing is, today is September 11th, we're recording. There's an article that came out last year on Politico called We're the Only Plane in the Sky, and it's an oral history of the people on Air Force One on September 11th, 2001. And it's kind of a step-by-step process that walks them through their day. And it's very interesting. There's stuff from Karl Rove and Ari Fleischer and Secret Service guys and Condi Rice. And it's just a fascinating look at what was going on around the president in Air Force One on that day.
Awesome stuff. I also have a couple online things pertaining to 9/11. One of which being the ESPN short film called First Pitch, which has to do with George Bush throwing out the first pitch at Yankee Stadium in Game 3 of the 2001 World Series. It's incredibly powerful and moving, and I mean, I watch it every year. I cry every year watching it, and it's a fantastic, well-done piece. There's also a short film on YouTube called The Falling Man Behind the Photo, and it's a story behind the famous photo from 9/11 called Falling Man, of a man falling from one of the towers. And it kind of just goes into the story behind that photo and how that photo is just so powerful and moving. The last thing is, I've spoken on this podcast before of my love of Jason Isbell, and he recently did a Tiny Desk session with NPR where he played three of his songs, and man, can this guy sing and play in real life. He is every bit as talented as you would expect him to be, so... Jason Isbell, Tiny Desk, Falling Man, Behind the Photo from Time Magazine, and ESPN's 30 for 30 short film, First Pitch.
That Jason Isbell is so good.
Yeah. Ooh, so good. So, so good. Yeah, so 46 days till Stranger Things. Get ready. I'm going to guess we'll probably do a review on Stranger Things Season 2, because we all love it. And that'd be kind of fun to do a little TV review.
Yeah, TV!
But yeah, that's all we have for now. So... If you liked what you've heard tonight, please recommend us to a friend. That's how we're going to grow. That's the best way to show us you love us, is recommend us to friends and people around you. So you can send your friends to iTunes, tell them to write a review or subscribe to us on there. You can send them to our website at popcornoptional.com, where you can listen to all of our episodes, find out a little bit more about each of the three of us, and get in contact with us. If you want to read funny tweets from Jake and Trevor, you can go to the Popcorn Optional Twitter page at Popcorn Optional. We also have a Facebook if you're into that, which is also at Popcorn Optional. I'm Cameron Salina. You can find me on Twitter at 321CammyTime. Jake, where can we find you online?
Find me at jakebrown.tv. That's my website and my Instagram handle. Trevor, what about you?
I'm on Instagram and Twitter at TurboTrevor.
That's all we have for this week. We'll be back next week, but until then, pop, pop.
We're committing.
I'm leaning
that's
hard
the sign
into
off.
It.
There it is.
I don't think I could quote a better quote.
Okay. Bye.